Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We'll hear a Middle East forum hosted monthly during the fall and spring semesters by the Hannah and Nataj Falb Center for Israel and Jewish Studies. The panelists, all members of the University of Nebraska at Omaha faculty, will be Moshe Gershovich, Professor of History, Ramazan Kalinch, Assistant Professor of Political Science, and Christian Peterson, Assistant Professor of Religious Studies. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, January 21st, 2016, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the panelists and do not necessarily represent those of the University of Nebraska at Omaha, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Today's program will examine the questions, will the war against ISIS enter its final stage in 2016? How will the recent crisis between Iran and Saudi Arabia influence the Middle East? And how have developments in the Middle East shaped the American presidential campaign, and what role will the region play in 2016? Here now to introduce the program is Curtis Hutt, Assistant Professor of Religious Studies at the University of Nebraska at Omaha.
Hello, I'd like to welcome all of you here to the first Middle East Forum of 2016. I do want to mention that we have a new guest on our panel. Dr. Patrick McNamara is in Japan, right, or going to Japan, and Dr. Christian Peterson, who is a professor of Islamic studies with a specialty in Asian Islam, and I think that most of you might know that most of the Muslims in the world are living in Asia as well. He has agreed to join us, and I'm going to give him the first question. As a way of introduction to the Middle East. It'll be a softball. I did also, though, want to make certain that everybody puts on their date cards, right? And it just went off the screen, so I know what date was it when Dennis Ross is coming for the Sokolov Lecture, which is sponsored by the Schwab Center. Dennis Ross, anybody who knows what's been going on in the Middle East for the last 20 or 30 years, Dennis Ross has been a big American representative of the American government and otherwise in the Middle East. So before I open it up, as is our custom, to the floor for all of your fascinating, difficult questions related to the Middle East for these experts, I normally ask a couple introductory softball questions. Okay, maybe not that softball. I think it's clear that the most important development in the Middle East since we've been away is the relationship between Saudi Arabia and Iran. This is especially in light of the United States has normalized relations in many different ways with Iran just very, very recently. That's an aspect of this. But I thought that Dr. Peterson, who is an expert on Islam, could talk about this divide and conflict between Sunni and Shia in the Middle East, please.
Sure. Well, thanks, first of all, for inviting me. I'm glad to see all of you here. In relation to sectarian conflicts in the contemporary moment, I think the way it's presented to especially American audiences is somewhat essentialized in the sense it seems like there's some sort of inherent conflict that is 1,400 years old. And while there are certainly differences between people who identify as Shia and Sunni, I don't think there's any kind of essential conflictual relationship that is inherent between the two groups. As many of you know, the early division was revolving around issues of political representation. There are also theological differences. This idea of who should rule after the death of Muhammad was based on also concerns about how is leadership continued on. So Shias generally see that not only the social, political leadership of Muhammad was important, but there was also something passed on, some sort of spiritual efficacy through his genealogy, through his descendants. So there's lots of differences in terms of theology, in terms of authority, who has the authority to make decisions, how this gets socialized into a lived reality, very often through legal reasoning and social boundaries. If we jump to the present moment, I think we need to focus on context, and I think many of the differences and conflicts that are happening, if we look in this case between Saudi Arabia or Iran, or even in places like Iraq where sectarianism is an issue, the religious aspect, right, these religious differences are often amplified and politicized in particular ways. So I would always encourage everyone to think about context in the moment, in the geographical location. What are the multiple and dynamic factors that are motivating decisions? I would argue that these are not somehow inherent in some sort of religious difference, in a theological difference that is motivating some sort of political violence. But these are often much more broadly contextualized issues that are revolving around economics, geopolitics, domestic concerns in places like Saudi Arabia or Iran, and how they position themselves in the Middle East. So, yeah, I don't know if that...
Well, maybe just so then to clarify,
yeah,
you don't look at the strife and the conflict between Iran and Saudi Arabia, Shia and Sunni in Iraq, as being primarily a religious conflict.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. And I think part of why the reason I want to start there is very often when we hear about this these kind of conflicts, sectarianism in the news, there's, oh, this is, right, a 1,400-year-old division, right? Why would we solve this now after all this time? This division has been going on forever. So this kind of ahistorical approach that says there's some sort of inherent difference that will always lead to some sort of violent conflict, I think is damaging for how we think about the historical trajectory of difference. Many of these differences, what I mean by politicized is governments, dynastic histories, they've used the discourse of Shia and Sunni difference for political gain or for material gain. And many of these differences, if we look historically among Muslims throughout Eurasia, we don't find this kind of necessary or essentialized conflict. There's been, people that would be identified as Shia today or Sunni today that have gotten along, have had shared sacred spaces, these kind of things. So while I think it's important to note the theological and ritual differences, I don't think we should necessarily apply that to specific historical conflicts such as the one going on between Saudi Arabia and Iran.
Thank you very much. I'm going to move on to there's three questions that we promised to answer, so I just hit the next one really, really quickly, and that is how much longer is this business with Daesh, right, with ISIS going to go on? And I know that Professor Gershovich has some thoughts on this, and I'd like to introduce him to the discussion now.
Thank you. First of all, I would like us later on maybe to get back to the Saudi-Iranian issue as well, because there are many more aspects to it beyond the introductory comments. I think that when it comes to the so-called Islamic State or the Caliphate, Daesh, in a sense, this has been very much the center issue towards the end of the year between Paris and San Bernardino in the whole discussion about the exportation of terrorism more to the core of the Western world, which I think more and more should be recognized not necessarily as a sign of strength of the caliphate, but actually as a sign of weakness on their part. And I think that in a sense, at least the way that I see it, I think that if we're talking about what happens in Syria and Iraq, in the territories captured by that organization, I'm cautiously optimistic that if the story is not going to be finished this year, it will be at least very much diminished in terms of the territorial holdings of Daesh. And I think that the strategy that has been employed, a careful strategy which may seem to some as a bit timid and indecisive, I think is actually the right approach in a sense of trying to limit, diminish, and eventually eliminate, but do it in a gradual way. I'm thinking of the metaphor of cancer and cancer treatment, and in a sense there is a lot, I think, to compare here, because right now we are at a stage where we are trying to shrink that phenomenon before removing it completely. And the thing is, our assistance from the outside, the shots we do from the outside, the equivalent of the chemotherapy, essentially, that we project into the body, cannot be substituted for the body itself, namely the Arabs, and more specifically Sunni Arabs in Iraq and Syria, taking charge and removing whatever remains of that entity. And I think this is the purpose, to help the Arabs, the Muslims, the Sunnis, and the Shiis to overcome Daesh, and to make sure that once that tumor is taken off, that there won't be a new growth, new mutations. And I think this is the real challenge and real task, and this is, of course, where the job will not be finished anytime soon, because radicalism and fanaticism and hatred is prevalent, and not really only in the Middle East, and this is the real threat. The real threat is long-term, and the one that we don't really have a concrete answer is the kind of what we've seen in San Bernardino. The people who are radicalized, not necessarily through direct contact, and people who decide on their own, the lone wolf phenomenon, as we started calling it. And this is something that we'll have to live with, and I don't think there is a simple answer for this. So on the one hand, I'm cautiously optimistic about dealing with the main body of the Islamic State. Even within this year, maybe it will take longer, but I can definitely see an ending to this. But how we deal with the long-term threat, I think that this is a much more challenging thing.
Thank you very much. I'm going to just return to the Iran-Saudi conflict a bit for Dr. Kilinch, and I'm going to ask him to do something a little bit different with it, to talk about it in geopolitical terms and talk about and I'm leaving this third question up for everyone, how all of this is going to affect American foreign policy, American elections, things like this. But what do you think this increased conflict between Sunni and Shia, Iran and Saudi Arabia, which has come to a head in just the last few weeks with the execution of a Shia cleric in Saudi Arabia, then the burning of the Saudi embassy in Iran, things are amping up here. Dr. Kilinch, could you talk about this and what this means for geopolitics?
Okay, thank you so much, Dr. Hutt. I was expecting to talk about American politics, but that's I will actually, my comments will complement Dr. Peterson's comments in a way that he said he ended with saying that this is not a sectarian thing, or not only, but mostly not a sectarian thing. So I will try to explain what are the geopolitics maybe behind it. Then what? If not sectarianism, then what is it? I think. But before saying that, I should note that even though at the elite level or at the strategic, geostrategic level, the real issue may not be sectarian, but considering its impact on social media, how it is perceived by the people, or how it is politicized by the leaders, as Christian said, there is still a sectarian danger threat, at least at the mass level, because in this time, people usually use social media, and they are not always nice in social media. So it can really increase some sort of sectarianism at the mass level. So it is probably more dangerous than the previous episodes in which sectarianism was somehow politicized by the leaders. But I think the real issue, at least in the last thing, was mostly about the changes in Saudi Arabia, because people were expecting that, okay, we had a nuclear deal with Iran, we will expect some stability in the region. And Iran fulfilled most of its promises, and on Saturday, International Atomic Energy actually released a report that Iran fulfilled the first requirements of the treaty, and there are some sort of release of sanctions against Iran. But at that time, Saudi Arabia was experiencing a power transition. They had a new king, and also Saudi Arabia was not supporting the Iranian nuclear deal diplomatically. So there was a concern that Iran is an emerging actor in the region. So to a degree, they actually are trying or testing the American way, American approach to the region, because they are forcing the United States to take a side between a newfound ally and a long-standing ally, the former being Iran and the latter being Saudi Arabia. So to a degree, and there are also some domestic crises. The price of oil is decreasing. The price of oil per barrel was about $110 in 2014, and it is about $30 today. So it is a big challenge for Saudi economy. So which means that Saudi government will have some difficulty to buy out legitimacy, to buy out people's support, consent through economic benefits to the society. So there are also some domestic issues. So taking people's attention from those issues to sectarianism helped in the domestic realm, and maybe provoking Iran to act a little bit more assertively, maybe to test American foreign policy in the region, which has not been in line with Saudi Arabia recently. So I think those are some of the probably geostrategic reasons behind the recent crisis. So to me, the real responsibility for the recent crisis is on Saudi Arabia, even though it doesn't mean that Iran, I'm approving whatever Iran is doing, but at least for the last crisis, I think Saudi Arabia is trying to escalate violence to keep its position in the region and to make Iran in trouble a little bit. This actually serves hardliners in Iran, their interests, and maybe those who didn't want nuclear deal even in the United States as well. So hardliners are gaining ground thanks to this move. If I talk a little bit about maybe its implications for U.S. foreign policy, I think U.S. should be very patient and not necessarily taking a side with Saudi Arabia in this particular thing, and should avoid doing something like that, I guess. Its ramifications for U.S. presidential debates, I don't know. It may probably come a bit later. I want to leave more time for the questions. So.
That, of course, was a very dramatic statement that Dr. Killench just made, that Saudi Arabia, maybe they shouldn't count on the United States being on their side. And that's big stuff. I'm going to open it up to the floor now, please.
Well, number one, maybe historically there hasn't been all of this contention, but then again, this current conflict didn't start yesterday. So I wonder if you can give us some more background. I mean, it's still a very, very serious thing. And the other question, speaker, is your specialty is Turkey. And it amazes me that Turkey, which has now been severely affected by ISIS, particularly in its tourist industry, to mention only one aspect, why the Turkish army, which is reputedly very powerful, isn't sent forth to really eliminate ISIS?
Dr. Peterson?
Sure. So if I can give kind of a brief, long image here. During kind of the formative and classical period of Islam, Shia and Sunni identities were not as fixed and perhaps more flexible at the time. There were many people that we would probably identify as Sunni who had great respect and love for the family of the Prophet, which is seen as this Shia characteristic. But the kind of contentious Shia and Sunni identities really start coming through in the Safavid and Ottoman period, where Safavids, which was basically a Persian empire in the 16th, 17th century, take on a strict and very fixed Shia identity in opposition to an Ottoman, which was, while the ruling class was Turkish, made up basically the Near East and North Africa. So it was many, many Arabs took on a very strict and hardened Sunni identity. So when these kind of theological differences that certainly existed before take on these kind of political opposition, this is what I mean by it's we should think of it as a historical trajectory. And now we can see the kind of political descendants, if we can think of it in that way, having similar politicized identities. So if we're thinking about a place like Iraq, where there's Sunnis and Shias in direct conflict, those identities have a much more recent history that are shaped on violence, access to power and resources. So if someone is in his opposition to a Shia or a Sunni, it's not necessarily them saying, oh, you have different theological opinions or you have different ritual practices, but it's more a product of this historical continuum where people have politicized these identities to work in opposition for their own political gain.
And by the way, an example of that would be Saddam Hussein. Right.
Yeah,
who was not religious, but then was.
And if I may just add to this, just a little more historical context of the last 3-4 decades. Mm-hmm. Basically, from the Iranian Revolution, which obviously had a lot of implications beyond, we have the decade-long Iran-Iraq war, where the question of Shia loyalty in the south of Iraq became a big issue. And this was part of a long suppression of the Shia, who are the majority in Iraq, and added to this Lebanon, where the Shia community, which is the same Shia as in Iran and Iraq, traditionally was a group that was not part of the, the group that was included equally between the Sunnis and the and the Christians. They always got a smaller share, and they got radicalized after the Iranian Revolution in the 80s, especially with the involvement of Israel in the war in Lebanon. That triggered it quite a good bit and brought about Hezbollah. In Syria, you have the Alawites, who originally were not really considered to be Shiites. They were sort of added to the Shia in a as part of the Syrian involvement in Lebanon and in conjunction with the Lebanese Shia. So, and they are, of course, a minority that rule the Sunni majority. I think that this context between Iraq under Saddam Hussein, of course, after when we invaded and perhaps inadvertently made the Shia the group in control, and to the extent that it was abused against the Sunnis, between Iraq, Lebanon, and Syria, this is where the core of the rivalry, and, of course, the other countries, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, that very soon Ramadan would say a few more things. The other Sunni countries trying to mobilize against what they regarded as the Shia ascendancy or the Shia crescent, and that pretty much triggered the recent history of this conflict.
Thank you, Dr. Kalinch.
Okay. It's a question that I've answered a few times, I guess, in the Middle East forums, the Turkey involvement in the ISIS thing. To me, there are two reasons. Maybe I can just summarize based on two things. First, Turkey is neighbor to Syria and Iraq, which means that Turkey accepted about 2.4, more than 2 million refugees in the last few years. And the refugee acceptance process in Turkey is not like the one that we are having. We are discussing in the United States to accept a few thousand refugees. We are discussing how we can accept them, some of the measures before they come into that investigations and so forth. What happens in Turkey is people escaping from ISIS or Assad or another group, they are just crossing through the border. So in such an environment, it is not easy to make really hard decisions. For example, Turkey in the last few months had two big terrorist attacks. So nobody can be sure how many terrorists are in Turkey at this point, ISIS-related people, because it is also not humane to close the borders completely when people are escaping from war. But at the same time, it comes with its own risk. I think that's one thing. If in a situation in which Turkish army is full-fledged in Iraq or Syria, there will probably be lots of bombings in Turkey and lots of terrorism inside the country. It will become a kind of new border like Pakistan and Afghanistan. So it will be another Pakistan in which the terrorists can pop up everywhere. I think that's one of the fears. But it is still not. It doesn't still explain Turkey's a little bit reluctant position toward ISIS. Turkey could still have played a stronger role, could join, it is in the alliance against ISIS, but could play a powerful role. I think it can be attributed to domestic developments in Turkey. The Turkish government, unfortunately, has become more authoritarian in the last few years, and corruption, authoritarianism has dominated the Turkish public discourse. And in those years, we also had three elections in Turkey, presidential election, parliamentary election, local elections, and so forth. So when the government was accused of increasing authoritarianism and corruption, they actually played the nationalist card. Turkish government, between 2010 and 13, started a new process called peace process to solve Kurdish question, and Turkish government was actually talking to PKK, which is considered by the Turkish state as a terrorist organization, having negotiations with PKK for the final resolution of the Kurdish conflict. But after all the domestic accusations against the government started, the government actually started to play the nationalist card in the election process. That peace process, so-called peace process, ended, and the government increased its pressure, repression, not only in Turkey but also in Northern Iraq. So PKK and Kurdish groups became an automatic enemy to the Turkish state at that process. So that actually, that nationalist card increased the tension with the Kurds, not only in Turkey but in Northern Iraq and Syria as well. So Turkish state started to consider those groups as an enemy, which are actually fighting against ISIS as well at the same time. So that complicated the situation a lot. So I think that if Turkish state had completed that process, today it is in a situation that people, for example, academics, who are inviting the government to start negotiation with PKK again, are considered terrorists as well. So you can consider the change of atmosphere, the change of tone in Turkey. So that actually, if Turkish state had completed that process and had had continued its good relationship with the Kurdish groups, I would imagine that Turkish state could have played a big role for the fight against ISIS. But it is not the priority in Turkey right now, which is a wrong diagnosis, because it will become a bigger problem for Turkey in the near future. But the leadership right now doesn't consider it as the most important thing as compared to other stuff. So.
Thank you. I think we have a couple questions.
Well, quick point. To me, the use of text, the organization of rituals, these are all political acts. So I don't think there is a religion apart from politics. So the question might be, is some secular person inflaming, or are they simplifying by talking theological terms when they have many things involved? But I just want to say this idea that somehow there's religion and then that gets politicized as if it isn't always already political seems a little question. So my question is more a political science one. How many of these states that we've been treating as modern states really have no future sort of infrastructure function without the petrol economy that's really, you know, tanking out and was going to be short-lived at some point in terms of the oil was going to run out at some point? And if there's nothing to them beyond that, are we just going to see these constant implosions of these so-called states? Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you very much for your question. Dr. Gershovich, please.
Yeah, I think that you really hit a very important point, and actually two points which combine to, when we think about the future of the Middle East, and especially the Arab countries in the Middle East, I think that it's the combination of these two factors, the fact that we have almost throughout the Middle East, with very few exceptions, failing states in moderate to severe degree. I mean, we have some countries like Syria and Iraq, which, frankly, especially Syria, I don't see how Syria can be put together again. I don't know about Iraq. I think if somehow they get some federal, true federal system, it may be still salvaged, but not very optimistic there. Libya, another example, Yemen. I mean, on the other side, we have Tunisia, maybe Morocco, that can be some glimmer of hope, but on the whole, it's either repression in the Egyptian style or failing state completely. And the other thing, the other factor, the oil economies and the revenues that, of course, directly went into the pockets of some countries, especially countries that have small population and and very wealthy, but also very stratified with a lot of foreign population. And of course, because they relied heavily on foreign labor from the Middle East and outside the Middle East, there was also the remittances that were going to poorer countries, Palestinian territories, Jordan, and Yemen and other countries, of course. And both of these are going to be very diminished, and we already see it, as Dr. Killinch mentioned, from $110 a barrel, it's went to under 30, and there is all the sign that it's a long-term thing, that the new reality is setting in. And I think, again, going back to the point about Saudi Arabia and what I think is somewhat of a desperation behavior on Saudi, it's all there. And these are long-term things. And I could add a third point, which relates to the other thing that we mentioned about the refugees going to Turkey, but beyond there to Europe and probably coming here. These are the best people that you can think of. The people who can live are the people who have either money or skill and education. These are exactly the people you want to stay and build. And these are the people that I think are going and are not likely to come back if the political situation changes. So I think the long-term trajectory for the Arab portion of the Middle East, at least, is very, very bleak.
Thank you.
Can I just make...
Please, Dr. Peterson.
So, I just wanted to clarify that. I'm not saying religion is some sort of social thing that happens here and is unique and separate from everything else. It's more that these identities get politicized, right? So if you ask your Muslim friends and neighbors here if they're Sunni or Shia, it means something very different to somebody in Iraq or Iran or Saudi Arabia. Those identities are tied up with national identities as well. So that's all I kind of...
Thank you, please.
I have two questions, actually. The first one is, the Chinese president is visiting the Middle East now, and he is actually visiting Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Egypt. Is that going to bring any peace to the area? And he's not visiting at the same time Turkey, which is one of the powerful states in the region. Is that going to make Turkey losing relationship with China or no? My other question is, Iran now is having the nuclear deal with the U.S., and they will get a lot of money from many countries around the world. They are trying to increase their oil production. Is that going to make the economic situation worse in the region or no? Thank you.
Thank you for your questions.
Somebody want to...
You want to pick the Chinese?
Sure. Well, so in relation to China, I would just say that China has had a long relationship with the Middle Eastern countries and positions in Africa as well. I don't know if these are going to bring peace. I think they're more economically driven, and we see lots of, in places like Egypt, in the Gulf, lots of Chinese residents that are working and Chinese businesses that are basically trying to foster economic growth for China. I don't have enough background to say if this is really going to bring peace, but I think they're driven by other strategic purposes rather than peace in the Middle East.
Maybe I can also I can talk on the other question. The Iran, of course, when Iran starts selling its oil in international market without any restrictions, as it has been the case for so long, it will shake the economies of other countries. One of them being Saudi Arabia, because then Iran will be a real competitor, not regulated by international norms and sanctions. And I do think that in the recent conflict between the two countries has also something to do with it, as I mentioned in my earlier remarks, because Iran, Shias, for example, in Iran, they have been harassed in the past as well, like harassment, repression, it happened. But, for example, in the recent issue, the leader, the Shia leader, Nimr, he was just executed, which is a huge blow, right? He could have been just arrested, imprisoned, harassed, those things could have happened. So I think there is a real fear in Saudi Arabia that they just want to play the sectarian card in case economy gets worse. People can rely around the ideology of the state and can still keep their support by playing that card. So they really needed politicization of sectarianism. That shows me just the recent development. Execution shows me that they badly needed politicization of the issue to keep support, probably.
The polls seem to say that terrorism is the number one issue for our election coming up, and you go from carpet bomb, keep Muslims out, to let them fight it out and everything will be okay. And that's just Republicans. Who do you think this difficulty of the issue and yet the importance of it favors which party and which candidate in this year?
Dr. Gershovich, I know he's ready for this here.
I'll try to take a stab at it, not trying to be too political myself, but it's difficult. I think that in a sense, the fascinating thing that we see, and it crosses a little bit across the, it may not seem that way so much with the Republicans, but certainly with the Democrats, between total anti-establishment positions, you know, the government is the problem and should be out of it, versus the people who are thinking a bit more continuity. And I would say in the Republican side, I would think a little bit Jeb Bush maybe and Kasich and people like this maybe thinking a little more in line of where reality is rather than the kind of alternative world that other candidates and their constituency, which they are catering for, are creating. I think that it was a very sobering moment when the president was here, and of course before then the State of the Union, when he tried to put things straight. You know, America is still the number one military power in the world and still the one that in many ways calls the shots, versus the idea that America is feeble, is, you know, we are all scared of terrorists, they're out there to get us, we need to do whatever those radical solutions for this. And in a sense, I think of all the candidates that I see, the one that probably is the one to continue for sure the kind of prudent, careful, well thought of policy is Hillary Clinton. I mean, obviously, given her experience as Secretary of State and previously, I think that while she may go a little bit to the right of Obama in some issues, especially in Syria and possibly with respect to Israel, I think that on and on, this is more of the continuity. And I think that if we are looking for consistency in our foreign policy, this is probably the surest bet for this. On the other extreme, of course, as you mentioned, candidates like Trump and Cruz who have all these sound bites. It's not really ideas. There is no plan in there. You know, we are going to obliterate them. How? Well, but we're not going to send boots on the ground because this is not popular, so we're not going to say we will. We're going to do it. Just trust us. It's irresponsible talk. And hopefully, by the time that we have a candidate emerging on the Republican side, that candidate, whoever it will be, will try to cater more to the center and try to get a little more pragmatic for the non-base vote that they will need to get. I don't know, but the kind of things that we hear is not very conducive. And it's so much opposite to the real, what I think over the last few years, you know, the policy that had a lot of mistakes in it. I mean, I wouldn't pretend for a moment that the current administration has had just successes, certainly in the Middle East. I mean, Syria, there were many things they would like to take back, but there is an attempt at least to think long-term, to think beyond the immediate, beyond what people just want to hear right now. And I think this is the only realistic approach for a long-term success.
Thank you. Let's have another question.
Thanks very much. I'm just wondering if anybody could expand upon the, I suppose, the economic implications that cheap oil has in this sort of new era of, you know, $30 a barrel oil. For example, if we look adjusted for inflation, this new figure of around $30 a barrel trading price for oil is around the same as it was in the period between about 1953 and 1973, at a time when Iran and Saudi Arabia were arguably the two top powers in the Middle East. In a way, Saudi Arabia sort of playing second fiddle to Iran and the Shah's government. You know, does this, does I suppose this new era of the Iran nuclear deal pose some sort of emasculation feeling in the Saudi government that they're probably going to once again play second fiddle to a more respected and a more powerful Iran in that they're more cooperative on the world stage, and sort of a second leading point, more international figures like Malcolm Rifkin, a former UK foreign secretary, and Alan Duncan, a former UK foreign minister, have cited the potential instability that this cheap oil brings to those oil-rich countries in which they can no longer potentially afford to fund the either the tax-free or the very low cost of living for their people, which might result in internal domestic instability and possibly revolt, or who knows. So I wonder, with those two frames in mind, what you can say with this new potential era of cheap oil.
Thank you for your question, and you know, I'll simplify it as well. I mean,
is the deal that we have made with Iran, is that a shifting of American alliances? And what is the future of the House of Saud if the United States does not have their back and they do not have the oil? So,
okay, maybe so it is more political implications than economic implications, mm-hmm. Right?
Both.
Yeah. Okay. So for economic implications, I probably cannot speak that much. But for political implications, of course, the decreasing oil prices can influence the countries in the region, especially the oil-rich ones like Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Qatar. They have been trying to diversify their economies, but they are still heavily reliant on oil. For small countries like Qatar, probably it's not a big deal. They can still keep their system going for a while. But for Saudi Arabia, in which they have to, it's a big country with about 25 million people, it can create some problems for the economic stability, and the state can really feel itself more threatened. But this doesn't necessarily mean state failure, probably, because there are states in the region who kept some authoritarian tide even without oil, like Egypt, for example. Dirk was asking about a weak state question, maybe related to that. Those who doesn't have oil actually survived for so long. It was one of the most stable countries, a leader survived 30 years of rule, right? And he had maybe five American presidents. He talked to five American presidents when he was the president. So they can continue, but in terms of creating good for the society, in terms of increasing the lives of the people, the quality of the people, of course, it may have some ramifications.
Yeah, I think that Saudi Arabia is a fascinating thing, what's happening there. And I mean, in a sense, it's also the domestic issue of moving from a system that is based on kings in their 70s and 80s who are being replaced at greater frequency because of health, to now they are moving more and more. And I don't know if you've seen, I think a week or two ago in The Economist, there was a fascinating interview and reportage about this young, he's the deputy crown prince officially, so he's officially number three, but he's the one calling the shots. He's in charge of security and defense. He's in charge of this really weird thing that is happening in Yemen, where, you know, it was supposed to be a few weeks and it just keep on dragging and draining resources from the Saudis and having all sorts of human rights application. He's in pretty much in charge of also of the economy. He's speaking about privatizing Aramco and all sorts of other things. I really recommend reading this. In a sense, I think the Saudis are moving from stagnation to hyperactivity regionally as well as domestically. And in a sense, I trace senses of real panic. I mean, I don't know if it's a matter of a year, 5 years, 10 years. I'm not optimistic about the future of the House of Saud. I don't think you can continue the system with this type of economy, with this type of prices, with this inability to continue essentially bribing the population into a deal that they would accept oppression while getting economic well-being. This is unsustainable. I'm not that optimistic about the smaller principalities, because in many ways they depend on the big brother, the big Saudi brother. We saw it in Bahrain, that the ruling elites rely on the projection of Saudi power, and the projection of Saudi power is diminishing. Long term, I think that I think it may be premature to speak of a new American-Iranian alliance. Even when you spoke earlier about normalizations of relations, I think it's a little bit early, because the struggle between the hardliners and the moderates in Iran is still ongoing. I think there are reasons to be cautiously optimistic that long-term the moderates or the pragmatists in Tehran are going to prevail, but I think it is a little bit premature right now to predict it. But certainly with respect to the Saudis, my projection is very gloomy.
Thank you. Some more questions here.
Last fall, I recall an interview with a former U.S. military commander who said that in Ramadi, the Iraqi army outguns and outmans Daesh by a factor of 10 to 1, but we shouldn't expect any sort of mobilization from the Iraqi army anytime soon. Last December, the Iraqi government, they declared that they had retaken the city. Were any of you surprised by that, that the Iraqi army had mobilized? How surprised were you?
Well, in a sense, it's definitely a positive sign. And the most important thing about it was that the Iraqi soldiers who took Ramadi in December were Sunni. They were not mostly Sunni. They were not the Shia militia, which are loyal to Iran, which initially were the force that was stopping Daesh from expanding further. They've been, to a large extent, neutralized and removed from here, because it was very clear that if they are going to retake Ramadi, there will be ramification in terms of their treatment of the population. And I think right now the most important thing beyond the military retake of cities, and ultimately the big prize in Iraq would be Mosul, is to make sure that the Sunni population knows that what happens after is going to be peaceful, is not going to be revenge. And once they do this, their willingness to work with the Daesh authorities is going to diminish. We already see it with the fact, as you, I'm sure, all read about the slashing of salaries after we hit that money depot. I think that the so-called caliphate is going to implode from within, first and foremost, and the pressure from the outside will just finish it, because, you know, the idea that they have that they can actually create a functioning state long term is fanciful. And it's always been fanciful. The only reason that they were successful was that, A, the domestic forces in Iraq and Syria were so weak, as the question referred to the way that the Iraqi army handled itself last summer, and before then, the year before. Of course, Syria being what it is. But also the fact that the forces that are supposed to fight ISIS, the external forces, Turkey, Russia, the U.S. is the only one who really identified Daesh as the number one target. All the others have other targets before, the Kurds, preserving the Assad regime, whatever. the Saudis having Iran. So Daesh was always number two or three in the priority list, and only when, if, and I think there were steps taken to finally put Daesh as the number one target. So the combination of strengthening the internal forces and getting the focus of the international forces against Daesh, plus the implosion from within, that's the reason why, as I mentioned earlier, I'm cautiously optimistic about the ability to overcome that cancerous entity.
Thank you. More questions.
All right. So David Rappaport talks about the four waves of terrorism and the one that we're currently in, the religious wave, started in 1979. Since he says these generally last about 30 to 40 years, do you see the religious wave ending anytime soon or continuing on?
What I'll say, I don't know if I'd describe necessarily as a religious wave. Again, I think what groups like Daesh and the Taliban, other groups that use Islamic discourses to justify their actions, I think what it offers them is a way of talking about violence, about power, which isn't authorized to them within the current state parameters that they exist in. So I don't know, you know, personally, if the particular actors in a group like Daesh are truly motivated by some sort of religious, right, or internal connection to God that then motivates them to do this. What I think Islamic discourses provide is a way of talking about political power, about justified violence that they can utilize outside of state apparatus, right? So, I mean, states use power and violence all the time, but it's talked about in different ways that are seen as legitimate. So whether we want to call this religious violence or not, or religious fundamentalism or terrorism, I don't know if I would go that far, but I think that those are the types of reasons why people use those types of explanations or justifications.
I'll just add something really, really quickly to that as well, and that is, you know, in the prior decades, there was this understanding amongst religious studies scholars, and Christian and I are both in the religious studies department, that with the Enlightenment, with science, that religious groups would in fact start to disappear, right? You know, reasonable people would not be as religious. Those views have aren't really all that credible, especially in light of the increase in religious fanaticism across the globe, right? So if somebody thinks it's going to disappear in 20 or 30 or 40 years, you ask a religious studies scholar, they might not be so optimistic, or at least this one isn't. Please.
Okay, so currently there's a proxy war in Yemen between the Saudi Arabia and Iran, and since the Iranian nuclear deal, it's probably fair to say relations will be on the downturn. Do we expect that conflict to escalate after the after the recent developments in the Iranian nuclear deal?
We brought Dr. Christensen on just to answer questions about Yemen. So, no, I'm... want to give that one a shot? Or
if you want, yeah. I mean, there's been tribal conflicts in Yemen for decades, with external actors playing a large part in supporting this materially. I don't think it's going to be a quick turnaround in terms of political stabilization in the region. But then again, I'm not an expert on Yemen.
So. Well, I'm not an expert on Yemen, yeah. But Iranian nuclear issue, it was not a magic thing that will resolve everything, right? So it was just one of the issues that we see in the Middle East, and still, the geostrategic competition between Iran and Saudi Arabia is in play, and Yemen also has its own problems. Seeing Yemen as a proxy war, it's not wrong, but it's not also the full reality. There are also lots of instability, domestic issues that we see in Yemen, which is neighbor to Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia sees lots of interest in being more influential there. As long as Yemen will continue to be neighbor to Saudi Arabia, I think the things will continue.
And I think there is a little bit of an optical issue here. You know, the involvement of the Iranians is actually far less apparent as what the Saudis want us to believe. They may be arming the Houthis, but they're not fighting there directly. Unlike in Syria, where in Syria they invest a lot of their own people in fighting to save, or I guess it's still to save Assad, although it's a question for how long. They never done this in Yemen. And let's remember, in Yemen, the Houthis are indeed Shia, but they're not the same Shia as those in Iran, Iraq, and Lebanon. They're a different type. And I don't know that their interest is, again, as a Shia interest. They are one of the groups, as Dr. Peterson said, it's more tribal. It's a little bit more in the style of Libya. It reminds me more of Libya than of the other countries. I think the Saudis have really overplayed their card big time in Yemen. They got stuck there, as I mentioned earlier. They thought it would be something for a few weeks, and they'll just rout the Houthis and restore the deposed president and secure things. I think they botched things big time. They are increasing their involvement. They are getting into a real human rights crisis because the number of civilians that are killed, and nobody is really speaking too much about it because they are presumed allies in this. I think it's a dead end for them, and I really don't know where they're going to take it further beyond this. I mean, how can they escalate it more other than just... I mean, they're not going to send their ground forces there, I think. So I don't know how they can escalate it more, but I don't think they know how to pull out from there either. It is a classic case that, of course, we've seen with so many other countries, including us, in a few situations, like in a place called Vietnam.
I want to thank you all for coming to this year's first Middle East Forum. We will be meeting in February. Have a nice rest of the day.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We've heard a Middle East Forum, hosted monthly during the fall and spring semesters by the Hannah and Natan Schwalb Center for Israel and Jewish Studies. The panelists, all members of the University of Nebraska at Omaha faculty, have been Moshe Gershovich, Professor of History, Ramazan Kalinch, Assistant Professor of Political Science, and Christian Peterson, Assistant Professor of Religious Studies. The moderator has been Curtis Hutt, Assistant Professor of Religious Studies at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, January 21st, 2016, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the panelists and do not necessarily represent those of the University of Nebraska at Omaha, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Today's program has examined the questions, will the war against ISIS enter its final stage in 2016? How will the recent crisis between Iran and Saudi Arabia influence the Middle East? And how have developments in the Middle East shaped the American presidential campaign, and what role will the region play in 2016? The 2016 Ruth and Phil Sokoloff Lecture, referred to in Dr. Hutt's introduction, will take place on Tuesday, April 5th at 7:30 p.m. in the Thompson Alumni Center on the UNO campus. The speaker will be diplomat and author Dennis Ross. He'll speak on the topic, U.S.-Israeli Relationship, From Truman to Obama. Special thanks to Casey Davis, staff assistant with the Schwalb Center for Israel and Jewish Studies, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 500 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.